Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Bob Dylan is the voice of a generation, a towering songwriter, and a bald-faced liar. Hear a 20-year-old Bob Dylan tell one whopper after another as we open up the WNYC archives to celebrate the station's 90th anniversary this week. Also on tonight's show, live music from the terrific Brooklyn synth-pop trio Au Revoir Simone. But first, as you may have heard, this month we're celebrating music from the summer of 1994. So far we've talked about everything from Boys to Men to Nick Cave, from Lisa Loeb to the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, and if you missed any of it, don't worry, it's all online at soundcheck.org. But now, we know that our Summer of 94 series has truly arrived, because it has its own theme song. Yes, with apologies to that chiseled 80s rocker Bryan Adams and his hit song, The Summer of 69, I present to you Soundcheck's Summer of 94 theme song. So there it is, our Summer of 94 theme song. This goes on for almost 2 minutes, by the way. Many thanks to our engineer Paul Schneider, who recorded it, and especially to Tim Rudiman of the Dexter Lake Club Band, who sang this with an exceptional amount of gusto. He's really quite insistent about it, isn't he? We want to hear your stories about what you were doing in that summer of 94 and what you were listening to. Leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or post a comment at soundcheck.org. Maybe you were being swept up in the whole zeitgeist known as Britpop. Twenty years ago, the bands Blur and Oasis released albums that renewed the mainstream music world's interest in British rock. Today, we'll focus on Blur, and especially on their seminal 1994 album, Parklife. Now, just to make sure everyone knows who we're talking about, this is Blur. If you attend sporting events, watch TV commercials, play video games, or even if you just leave your home on a regular basis, you have heard this song. It's called Song 2, and it appeared on Blur's 1997 self-titled album. It is, hands down, Blur's best-known song. But writer Michael Nelson thinks it shouldn't be that way. Michael's the managing editor of the music site Stereo Gum, which recently dedicated a whole week to the 20th anniversary of Britpop. You can find a link at soundcheck.org, and Michael's here to present The Soundcheck Guide to Blur, with a special emphasis on that pivotal year, 1994. Hi, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, people know Song 2. It's an easy way to say, this is Blur, but it is not representative of Blur, is it?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's a single song that's really representative of Blur. They sort of, every song in their catalog is sort of different from every other song in their catalog. So Song 2, it's not so much that it's not representative. I just think that it's a little bit clumsier than the best Blur music.
So inevitably, it becomes the huge hit. The sing-along anthem in sports arenas.
Absolutely. Certainly in the United States. I'm not sure it was the same in the UK, but over here, yeah.
Well, now, so we're in talking about the summer of 94, we've been asking people where they were, what they were listening to. Where were you? What were you listening to?
Well, I mean, I was in New York City at the time. I was a college student at NYU. And I mean, I was listening to alternative rock of all stripes at the time, which included stuff like, you know, Weezer's first album had just come out then. Beck's Mellow Gold was pretty new at the time. Pavement, obviously. You know, the American indie rock and the extensions of the American indie rock movement. But, you know, I was personally, and I think a lot of New Yorkers especially, were really getting into the British pop that was being imported at the time. And those albums really were incredibly exciting and new.
I mean, Oasis here in the States is the one people know.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Blur really gave birth to the movement in 1993 with their album Modern Life is Rubbish, which was not, it didn't really make any sort of impact in the States. And in 94, when Park Life came out, that was their real coming out, their real international smash. And then once Oasis arrived, I think once you had, I mean, eventually they became a foil. But if nothing else, at the time, it sort of signaled that there was a movement more than just a cluster of bands. And I think that with the arrival of Definitely Maybe, that's when you sort of said to yourself, wow, something big is happening here.
So let's start at the beginning with Blur's first album, Leisure, from 1991. This is kind of pre-Britpop Blur.
Absolutely, yeah. As a matter of fact, their label encouraged them, sort of forced their hand into sort of borrowing the sound of the Stone Roses and the Charlatans, who were doing this indie rock dance hybrid that was very popular in the late 80s and early 90s. And by the time Leisure came out, was already sort of on the wane. But Food, you know, sort of wanted to milk every last ounce of currency that they possibly could from it. So they had Blur record this record. And it did produce some great songs, but it wasn't the voice of the artists.
Although Damon Albarn's voice is pretty much, you know, it's a pretty distinctive voice.
Absolutely, yeah. I think you can hear it really clearly.
There's No Other Way is the name of this song, early song from the band Blur. Song from the band Blur. There's No Other Way is from their 1991 album Leisure. I hear echoes of like late 60s, early 70s in that, as well as the kind of Madchester, the so-called Madchester music that you were referencing, Stone Roses, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Madchester scene sort of borrowed from a lot of that music in general, so I agree with you.
Michael Nelson's with me on Soundcheck, managing editor for the music site Stereogum, which recently dedicated an entire week, marking 20 years since the high point of Britpop. And we'll get to the Summer of 94 album from Blur, Park Life, in just a moment. But something comes in between 1993's Modern Life is Rubbish, and this really is a Blur record.
Yeah. So while touring the United States for Leisure, they weren't seeing large crowds at their shows. They were feeling very disenchanted. At the time, Nirvana was dominant. And In the UK, Suede was really on the rise, and Damon Albarn was traveling across the United States in a tour bus listening to a Kinks tape and seething with anger at how his band was not, you know, the dominant force in British music. And so he wrote this record, Modern Life is Rubbish, the first true Britpop album. I would absolutely say it was the birthplace of Britpop. And it's, in my opinion, pretty close to a masterpiece. I don't think it's up. I don't think it quite reaches the level of Park Life, but at its peaks, it's absolutely as good as anything from the era.
Well, the chorus to this song, Blue Jeans, you wrote, it's nitrous oxide as music.
I love this song. It's my favorite Blur song. And I think part of that is because Blur are a great songs band. Every song is a complete statement on its own. And Blue Jeans was never a single. It's an overlooked song in their catalog. I think it's absolutely the most beautiful song they've ever written. And it really signals a lot of places they would go with their more melancholy, gentler music. And I just think it's absolutely gorgeous.
That is Blur with Blue Jeans from their pivotal 1993 release called Modern Life is Rubbish. You hear Damon Albarn singing. We should mention Graham Coxon. His guitar playing is an equal part of the sound of this band.
You know, I was thinking about this morning. Absolutely, in terms of the sound. And also, I think I don't know that you could have a Blur without any one of the members. I mean, for their final album, Think Tank, actually, Graham Coxon only contributed to one song and then left due to some creative differences. And it's a fantastic album, just the same. And a lot of Blur fans disavow it entirely because Graham's not involved. But I think you really need all four pieces, which is Damon Albarn, Graham Coxon, bassist Alex James, and drummer Dave Roundtree. It's not like Oasis where it's the Gallagher brothers and three other random rotating contributors. Right. Blur is these four people.
All right. So let's go back to the summer of 94. In April, the album Park Life is released. And by the summer of 94... there is a Blur song being heard on modern rock radio here in New York and in the States.
Sure, yeah. Girls and Boys, which was it's the first song on Park Life. It was the first single from Park Life. It's absolutely Park Life's calling card. And the same way we said earlier that song two isn't really representative of Blur sound, the same Girls and Boys is absolutely also not representative of Blur sound. And it's probably the second best known Blur song. It leads off the album and it just starts on a bang, on a great note.
Back in 1994.
Me too, man.
Girls and Boys by Blur from their 1994 album Park Life. Michael Nelson's with me here in the Soundcheck studio with the Soundcheck Guide to Blur, part of our series looking back at that summer of 20 years ago. And, you know, in retrospect, you listen to that and Damon Albarn's voice is processed in such a way, you know, the reverb around it, that it's maybe not immediately apparent that that's Damon Albarn's voice. And I've seen a lot of people over the years saying, that's Blur?
Right, absolutely.
You know, it was one of those songs, you heard it on the radio, you weren't sure who it was. On the other hand, when the band Gorillaz came out and they weren't telling us who any of the musicians were, as soon as he opened his mouth and started singing, it's like, oh, there's Damon Albarn.
Yeah, absolutely. We just did a piece yesterday, actually, on Gorillaz on Stereogum, and the writer led off by saying something to the effect of, it's surprising how many people, when you talk to them about Damon Albarn, where they know him from, be it Blur or Gorillaz or any of his other work, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Queen, Rocket Juice and the Moon. He's done dozens of
his opera Monkey.
Absolutely, Monkey. Yeah. His other opera, Dr. D. So where they know him from, and then where they know him from but don't know they know him from there. So be it Girls and Boys or Song 2 or Clint Eastwood or whatever Gorillaz song. I mean, you know, the guy has a very prominent body of work, and you don't always associate him with the work itself.
Right. And Soundcheck listeners, if you go to soundcheck.org and type in Damon Albarn's name, you'll find his visit here in our studio from around the time of the opera Monkey. But let's go back to Park Life, this 1994 record. Girls and Boys, it's a fun song. It's kind of a, you know, the dance music that was in the air at that time.
Yeah, I think it's actually sort of both a dance song and a comment on the sort of dance culture at the time. So it's a little bit of a meta commentary as well as being the genuine article.
So you were talking before about how Damon Albarn, while touring the States, an unproductive tour of the States early in the band's career, decides to go all kind of British. He's going all in.
Right.
And this next song, Clover Over Dover,
right,
seems to be one of those.
One of the interesting things about Park Life in general, and why I think it's both appealing to American listeners and also sort of can be difficult, impenetrable to American listeners, is that it's so uniquely and almost standoffishly British. I mean, there's a song on the album called Bank Holiday, which to me, you know, not only is it something that Americans don't have any concept of, but it's sort of saying like, we have this, you know, bank holiday six times a year and you guys don't have this thing. So, and I think that's true of a lot of the record. I mean, there's a lot of impenetrable Britishisms, which is what makes it both I think it makes it quite fascinating. And if you're – especially at the time in 1994, if you were a certain sort of musical elitist, which a lot of American Blur fans were, you really embraced that sort of alien culture that, you know, being presented to you and you were being asked to confront. And Clover Over Dover, I mean, obviously – you know, the title alone sort of speaks to a Britishness, but musically as well. It's one of the few songs in the album that wasn't a single. I think there were five singles, and Clover Over Dover is not one of them. It was originally recorded or written as a ska song, which I can't hear those roots whatsoever,
hear it,
right? It's just a beautifully delicate and gentle song, and I think it's I think it's probably the song on Park Life that is not a single that people should associate themselves with, because it's really wonderful.
Clover Over Dover from Blur. Damon Albarn channeling his inner Ray Davies.
Absolutely, as he does quite frequently.
Ray Davies of the Kinks, of course. Now, Michael Nelson with us here on Soundcheck. We're looking back at the summer of 94, and he's giving us the Soundcheck Guide to Blur, one of the two big Britpop bands. And, of course, the other is Oasis.
Of course.
Whose Definitely Maybe comes out a little bit later,
yeah,
right?
I believe it was August 1994, but it was later in the year. It was a few months later.
So, but still part of that summer.
Very much so.
And that music, you know, transfers, despite also being very British, transfers to this side of the Atlantic with no problem somehow.
Right, absolutely. Well, I mean, it wasn't nearly as specific as Blur. It was much more, it's aspirational music. It's not, Blur were really writing character studies, you know. I mean, and especially on Park Life. I mean, I think Damon Albarn said he really wanted to just sort of examine life in London, and Noel Gallagher of Oasis has said that Park Life really is a perfect picture of a certain individual in South London in 1994. Whereas Definitely Maybe was just the sort of soaring, reaching music that I think anybody could embrace.
So, Michael, we asked you to identify a low point from somewhere in the career of Blur, and you said Song 2, their biggest hit.
Well, you know, I'm my wife told me that I would be trolling or actively inflaming your listeners by naming Song 2 in this case, but I really couldn't think of another song. Blur's lifespan, I think, I really don't think there's a single bad album in there. The closest thing they have to a bad album is their first album, right. Leisure. The reason I chose Song 2 as a song to avoid is not because you shouldn't listen to it or love it. It's a fantastic song.
But it casts a huge shadow, doesn't it?
I think it's just ubiquitous in a way that is sort of unfair to the body of work, I mean, of Blur and then of Damon Albarn beyond Blur. It's a terrific song, though. I don't want to take anything away from it.
But the song called This Is a Low is, yes, in fact, not a low point.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, it's a very morose song, and in that sense it's a low, but it's the final moment you're sort of left with on Park Life, and it's the soaring, you know, deeply aching ballad, and I think it's certainly one of the high points of their career and of Park Life as well. I mean, there's few low points on Park Life, but This Is a Low is really one of the standout tracks.
Michael Nelson's been with us, managing editor for the music site Stereo Gum. You can find a link to his article and to their whole week of coverage of 20 years of Britpop on our website at soundcheck.org. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
And on the
coming up, we'll ask the members of the Brooklyn synth-pop trio Au Revoir Simone to weigh in on the whole Blur versus Oasis thing, and we'll hear them play live in our studio. And today is WNYC's 90th birthday. We'll mark the occasion by listening back to some very tall tales told by a young Bob Dylan on WNYC back in 1961. All that coming up on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here in the studio with me today is the band Au Revoir Simone, but there's no one sitting at our drum set or tuning up a guitar. The bandmates Erica Forster, Annie Hart, and Heather D'Angelo all play keyboards, and they're going to start us off with our live session today playing a song called Crazy. There is a little bit of electric bass in this tune, but it's pretty keyboard heavy, and it's off their latest album called Move in Spectrums. This is Au Revoir Simone playing live on Soundcheck.
Made became the one account.
That is Au Revoir Simone, live on Soundcheck, with a song called Crazy. It appears on their most recent album called Move in Spectrums, and that's a live performance from Erica Forster, Annie Hart, and Heather D'Angelo, all playing keyboards and singing, although on that song, Annie was playing the bass. Is that new? Is that new to the lineup of the band?
Well, in our last album, Still Night, Still Light, we had a song called Shadows that was the Rhodes keyboard with bass as the primary instruments. And I just realized are also the primary instruments of this song.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Heather was playing, as she usually does, the drum machine.
Yes.
And Heather, I was wondering, you know, whether it's a sort of a confining thing to play to a drum machine, except that you literally are playing the thing. I mean, you know, you're triggering all the different patterns.
I'm triggering different loops, yeah. I mean, it'd be really cool if I was actually... I mean, some people do actually play this because you can actually load up the SPDSX with, like, you know, a kick sound and a snare. And some mm-hmm. people actually do play it like that. But I'm just triggering loops. But, no, it's just... This is my job.
But it also means that you can respond to what everyone else is doing, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this has been a long kind of process where when we first started, we thought, oh, well, we'll just play the drums, like just start the whole song and just try to keep up with it. And then that was actually really rigid because,
yeah.
You know, if you mess up at all, then you've got like a chorus beat going during an outro or something. It doesn't work.
Well, and plus, you know, where's the spontaneity?
Exactly.
So how did you end up being the drum master?
I'm the worst keyboard player of the bunch. So. and I've always liked rhythm. I've always liked drums. But probably I like to be useful, I think, more than anything. And I just filled a void that was needed.
All right.
They're way better keyboard players than I am.
Now, Erica, you've done some solo stuff with a live drummer, a person behind a drum kit.
It's a lot louder on stage.
Do you have a preference for one or the other?
Gosh, I mean, we had a couple of songs on this album that we workshopped with a live drummer to try to figure out the beats. We write most of the beats ourselves and work with our producers, but that was really wonderful to be able to have somebody in the room who's really skilled in writing and being like, you know, that song that we just played, Crazy, we would workshop that and it would be like, okay, this is kind of, well, that sounds kind of country. Okay, this is like, that's a little too punk rock or this. I mean, that mm-hmm. is such an amazing thing. But yeah, I sometimes fantasize about, I think we all have thought about adding a drummer and a bass player to our band, but we've come to realize that this is our band. This is what we, the three of us, do in our rehearsal space and with our, you know, interesting, ever-changing combination of keyboards is sort of what we, and when we first started out, that was really, really weird. And now it's getting a lot less weird. And people, you can show up to a festival show and not have a drummer and people aren't like, you're not a real band.
Right, right. The members of Au Revoir Simone are performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Annie, I understand David Lynch has been a longtime fan of the band.
Yeah, he has.
Now, were you guys fans of his first?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm projecting, but I don't know if it's possible to not be a fan of David Lynch, just because even if you're not interested in everything he does, just the fact that he is so creative and so uniquely him,
mm-hmm.
I think in general, people really respond to authenticity in art. And I think that David's one of those people who is just so authentic in his vision that it's so wonderful. And we've had so many bonding experiences in the van, like watching all of Twin Peaks again and watching Mulholland Drive and just kind of having endless debates about the plot and getting it. And then, you know, he's just been such a wonderful supporter of ours. I can't even begin to say how appreciative I am.
All right,
of
real
that.
Real quick then, each of you, favorite David Lynch moment. Annie, you first.
Wait, personally with him?
No, like
I was
movie.
Like eating a tuna fish sandwich in his living room.
Okay,
you
then.
Know,
I would have said first six episodes of Twin Peaks, but you trump that by eating a tuna fish sandwich in the man's living room.
It was a good sandwich.
It was a great sandwich. He has a really good deli.
He has a really cool, like, music studio slash movie theater in his workspace.
And he's been doing a lot more music. I mean, he's always done music, you know, although that wasn't really always known. But and so now he's done a remix of one of your songs, right?
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. So, and that's the song Just Like a Tree, which we'll hear in a little bit. Au Revoir Simone is the band playing for us on Soundcheck today. You want to do Somebody Who next?
Great.
All right. The album, which is out now, is called Move in Spectrums. This song is on it, but here's a live performance from Au Revoir Simone. Somebody Who is the name of the song from the band Au Revoir Simone, performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today, playing some songs from their latest album called Move in Spectrums. So, you know, the band, I mean, the band name, obviously, from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, so you're referencing going back to the 80s. The sound of these electric keyboards with the drum machines, it seems to harken back to that time period as well, some of the new wave sounds. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely, and all these most of the keyboards were made in the 80s, so it's impossible to not sound 80s.
All right, well, but now, earlier, we were talking about, we've been talking all this month about the summer of 94, the summer 20 years ago. And we were talking earlier about Britpop and the advent of Blur. You know, summer of 94, they released their album Park Life, and then Oasis would release their record a few months later. Any Britpop fans among the three of you?
Yeah, definitely. I got into Blur later, probably like 4 years later, when I was 18 and somebody put Tender on a mixtape for me. So I don't think I knew about Park Life when it came out, but I actually was really into Oasis. I was such a Beatle maniac when I was a kid, so when that came out, it just felt right.
While Erica was saying that, Annie and Heather, in unison, were giving it the thumbs down. So you guys are not Oasis fans.
Don't like
I
Oasis?
I actively loathe Oasis.
If I hear Champagne Supernova, I get the shivers. I get like, ugh. Like, but Blur, that Park Life was a great album, and I really did enjoy that.
Was so, that, yeah, you know, a sound of that summer for you, Heather?
Summer of 90, when I was 14. That's pre-high school.
Pre-high school at 14?
Well, wait, no.
No, you were in 10th. Unless you were having serious trouble in eighth grade, you would have been well into high school by then.
So you're right. I think it was after freshman year. So I think I was still, when I was 14, listening to like radio music. I'm not sure if I was that cool at that point.
A lot of TLC for me.
Yeah, TLC. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was more like still Paula Abdul maybe, or like that area in my life.
I was getting into Green Day.
Ace of Base.
Green Day and TLC.
So wait a minute. So you're giving the thumbs down to Oasis, but you admit to listening to Ace of Base.
I had really bad taste then.
So who's in charge of the, you know, the iPod or whatever it is that you use on van rides between gigs?
The driver. Sometimes we listen to WNYC podcasts.
That's true.
Sometimes half the time.
Not a bad use of your time. The band is Au Revoir Simone. They've been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. It's been a lot of fun having you all here. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, a look back at Bob Dylan's first radio appearance in New York, which took place here in the studios of our home station, WNYC. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're celebrating 90 years of broadcasting here at our home station, WNYC Radio, this week. WNYC was founded by the City of New York back in 1924, and soon after, started playing music on the air. One of the longest-running programs in the station's history, in fact, one of the longest-running programs in radio history anywhere, is the show Folk Song Festival, hosted by Oscar Brand. That show has run continuously since it debuted on December 10th, 1945. Now, Oscar has always sought out and highlighted the best and brightest folk stars of the day. Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, Arlo Guthrie, Lead Belly, Pete Seeger all made their debuts on the Folk Song Festival. So did a certain singer and guitar player from Minnesota who sounded much older than his 20 years. In October of 1961, Bob Dylan joined Oscar Brand for his first radio appearance in New York. Now, to listen to that tape and talk about it, I'm joined on the line by Dylan biographer and former LA Times reporter Dennis McDougall. Dennis, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's good to be here.
Now, you've had a chance to listen to our little tape here from October 29th, 1961. What do you think of it?
Well, I thought it was hilarious, but I'm sure listeners at the time thought it was both fascinating and that this guy, Mr. Dylan, as he called himself, had led a very colorful life.
And he was all of 20 years old, but apparently packed a lot into it. Let's hear a little bit. The first voice you'll hear in this clip is our host, Oscar Brand.
Now, November the 4th, Saturday, Bob Dylan will be singing at the Carnegie Chapel. And that should be a very eventful occasion. Bob was born in Duluth, Minnesota, but Bob, you weren't raised in Duluth, were you?
I was raised in Gallup, New Mexico.
And did you get many songs there?
Got a lot of cowboy songs there, Indian songs, carnival songs, type vaudeville kind of stuff.
Now, where'd you get your carnival songs from?
People in the carnival.
Did you travel with it, or did you watch the carnival?
I traveled carnival when I was about 13 years old.
For how long?
For all the way up till I was 19. Every year, off and on, I joined different carnivals.
So from 13 to 19...
There you go.
Young Bob Dylan was a carny. Who knew?
There you go. And by gosh, I believed it. Jiminy Crickets. He certainly sounded like he'd been out there on the road.
Yep. You can actually hear Oscar Brand sort of stumbling as he was introducing Bob Dylan, because Dylan is playing. He's beginning to play while Oscar is talking on the radio, which was just not done. So give us the real scoop here. Where was Bob Dylan raised, and how did he end up in our studio with Oscar Brand?
Well, from 13 through 17, Bob was making his way through Hibbing High School in northern Minnesota. He envisioned himself, even back then, as a northern white version of Little Richard. In fact, that's what it says in his yearbook, that what he had hoped to do was to join Little Richard's band. That was his life's goal. But he moved from Hibbing down to St. Paul, where he attended the University of Minnesota for all of half of one semester.
Mm-hmm.
And he dropped out and lived in a college adjunct called Dinkytown for a couple of years off and on.
Did he ever live in Gallup, New Mexico?
Let's see. No. Nor did he live in Aptos, Texas, or Sioux Falls, North Dakota, or South Dakota, or any place else.
So this 20-year-old, he's making his first appearance on the radio in New York in advance of his first live performance in New York, and he's already full of BS. How does this happen, and where does he take it from there?
Bob decided when he was back in Dinkytown and he was first learning how to play the guitar and the harmonica that he was going to be a star. And he told his friends in the coffee houses back in Minnesota that what you had to do in order to be a star was to create a character that sells.
Mm-hmm.
And that is precisely what he set out to do. When you create a character that sells, you can't say, well, you know, I'm a Jewish kid from upstate Minnesota. Who's going to listen to you?
Yeah.
But if you embellish just a little, and you say you joined the carnival when you were 13 and that you ran away from home six times, and the last time they didn't catch you and bring you back, then people's ears perk up and they pay attention. And, well, here we are 50 years later talking about this interview. So
right.
I guess he was right.
We're speaking with Dennis McDougall, former reporter for the L.A. Times and author of the book Dylan, out now. So Bobby Zimmerman from Minnesota comes to New York. He is now Bob Dylan. And back to this 1961 recording from our WNYC archives and Oscar Brand's Folk Song Festival. Here, Dylan adapts a Woody Guthrie song for his first broadcast performance.
Well, now, I'd like to hear one of the kinds of music that you've been singing, and I know you've been doing quite well, and that you'll be singing at Carnegie Chapter Hall. Do you want to pick something out?
Well, I'll pick a carnival song that I learned. I wrote there. You want to hear one of them?
Thank you. Sally gal, I'm gonna get you, Sally gal. Well, I'm just one of them rambling men, rambling since I don't know when. Here I come and I'm gone again. Sally says I got no end. I'm gonna get you, Sally girl. I'm gonna get you, Sally girl. I'm gonna get you, Sally girl. I'm gonna get you, Sally girl.
That is a 20-year-old Bob Dylan, and his first performance on the radio in New York was right here in our WNYC studios with Oscar Brand on the Folk Song Festival. And, Dennis, the stones on this kid, man. He's telling Oscar Brand that he's going to play him a carnival song, and then he plays a Woody Guthrie, a kind of a variant on a Woody Guthrie song.
That's Bob for you. I mean, he doesn't. Stones, I'm not sure that we're talking about stones. I think we're talking about boulders. And he's had them all his life.
Yeah.
He's a confabulist down to the present day. And, people believe him. Go figure. I mean, all you have to do is look at his book, Chronicles, and, if you want current day proof of. How his ability to spin a yarn can go right out of the window and come back again, and people eat it up, and they believe it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that people have liked about your book, Dylan, is that it kind of, you know, it tries to unravel all of the mythology and the outright fabrications that have been woven by Dylan over the decades. Can you do that? Can you actually unravel all of that and get to something that you can point to and say, there, that's the real guy, that's the real truth?
Well, I'm not sure. It takes me back to that old aphorism about someone being a riddle wrapped in an enigma.
A mystery wrapped in a riddle wrapped in an enigma.
Thank you so much. And you know, when you get to the bottom, well, what's there except for an empty package? In Dylan's case, I mean, obviously there's a lot more there.
Yeah.
My contention is that part of this evolves out of his essentially living dual lives. I mean, we all live different roles in our lives, but Dylan's taken it to a new standard. There is Robert Zimmerman from upstate Minnesota, and there's Bob Dylan. And, boy, you know, as the years rolled by, that schizophrenia, if you will, has gone out of control at times.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun read. You should check out Dennis McDougall's book. It's called Dylan. It's out now. He's on the line with me, and we are listening back to some clips from this historic moment in 1961 when young Bob Dylan, just having arrived in New York, sat down with Oscar Brand here in our WNYC studios for his first radio appearance in New York. It was October 29th of 1961. And let's listen to a little more. In this clip, Oscar Brand is asking Bob how he recalls all of his varied source material.
Bob, I know that means when you travel that much that you hear a lot of songs, but doesn't it also mean that you forget a lot of songs that way?
Oh, yeah, I learned, forgot quite a few, I guess, and when I forgot them, I usually heard the name of them and looked them up in some book and learned them again.
Well, can you read music?
No, I can't, but this here song's a good example. I learned it from a farmer in South Dakota, and he played the otter harp. His name was Wilbur. Lived outside of Sioux Falls, and I was there visiting the people and him, and heard him do it. I was looking through a book one time, and I saw the same song, and I remember the way he did it, so this is the song. There was a wealthy old farmer that lived in county nearby.
He had a loving daughter on whom I kissed my eye. She was pretty fair and handsome and did so very fair. There wasn't a girl in the county with her that could compare.
A little bit of Bob Dylan doing The Girl I Left Behind. Another little bit of misdirection from a young Bob Dylan. Now, Dennis, I mean, you know, while your book does question, you know, Dylan and his motives and his fabrications, you are at heart a fan, right?
Oh, big time. I mean, you don't undertake a five-year project like this unless you really like your subject.
Mm-hmm. And what about that, you know, just hearing that little bit of that traditional song, The Girl I Left Behind, for a 20-year-old kid, that's pretty damn good, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's the thing that people forget about as far as Dylan is concerned. You know, he was first and foremost true to his music, true to the craft, true to folk, and all of the traditions. You know, he covered it up for years because he maintained that everything that he did was original, I think in part because he thought that's what the market demanded. But later on, you know, he got a little honest from time to time, and when he wasn't, he got discovered as having based an awful lot of his songs, most of them, in fact, on traditional child ballads or...
just to be clear, when you say child ballads, you don't mean children's songs. You're
talking... I'm sorry. I should have... no, child... there was a folklorist in British and Irish folk music.
Right.
Ballads that were collected... And much like Alan Lomax went through the American South and gathered up the blues in the 30s and 40s, and the child ballads became kind of a resource for folk musicians. And Dylan was an early advocate. I mean, we all know the Woody Guthrie story. Here's a kid who knows about Woody Guthrie at age 20, mm-hmm. and worships him to the extent that he hitchhikes to the village in the dead of winter in 1961 just so he can go visit Guthrie. I mean, that's dedication to your music.
Yeah. Could an artist get away with this level of fabrication in the digital age when you can source everything online and, you know, fact check, and there are, you know, you leave a digital trail of whatever you do and wherever you go?
In a word, no. What Dylan did with Brand, and then later on, a month or two later, with Cynthia Gooding, he'd never get away with that today, because somebody will discover it, and it'll be all over the internet among the people who are interested in it, almost within minutes. A lot of Dylan's early confabulations and made-up stuff began to unravel in the last 10 to 15 years as a direct result of people contacting each other through the internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it's still a lot of fun to go back and listen to tapes like this. Bob Dylan's first radio appearance in New York, October 29th, 1961, part of the WNYC archives. And Dennis McDougall, the author of the book Dylan, which is out now, has been enjoying it with me, and we hope you have too. Dennis, nice talking with you today.
Great talking with you, John.
I read down a little piece further just to see if these words were true.
You can check out more great audio from WNYC's archives as part of our 90th anniversary programming online at WNYC.org/90.
Love was the girl I left behind.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll dig through the WNYC archives again and listen back to a recording of the blues legend Lead Belly and his WNYC radio program. And record collectors, take note. Music writer Amanda Petrusich joins us to talk about her book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. All of that's coming up tomorrow, plus... Our series about the summer of 94 continues with a look at the Beastie Boys' album Ill Communication. In the meantime, check out the Summer of 94 on soundcheck.org. And hey, while you're there, subscribe to our podcast and our YouTube channel to get all of our latest stuff. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.